got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. I think most people wouldn't have a problem with the government funding children's health research. But what if you found out the government was giving your money to children's health centers that were promoting scare stories about pesticides and encouraging people to eat organic food, and all the while using organic industry-funded groups to promote these ideas? Well, according to my guest today, that's been happening for more than a decade. Angela Logomancini is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and she specializes in environmental risk and regulation. And she says the EPA and the National Institutes for Environmental Health Science continue to give millions of dollars to children's health centers that use money to finance environmental activism, not science. All right, Angela, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing today?
I'm very excited. It's Wednesday. Love Wednesdays. So, when people hear that the government is funding children's health research, that sounds pretty innocuous, but that's not the whole story based on this series of articles that you've written. So tell us what's going on here.
So basically, children's environmental health, right? That sounds like a great thing for researchers to be studying and finding out ways to improve and educate people. But it's launched back, I guess, in the 90s during the Clinton era. These programs are set up really, to some extent, if I would argue, to fund sort of activist science. The research is conducted at universities, so you expect that this is going to be unbiased scientific research. Studying such things as, could environmental exposures cause leukemia? Or why do African-American women have their babies prematurely? Is there an environmental cause? And if you're just doing straight research, there might be some value, you know, to researching these things. But what they're doing is they're doing a lot of advocacy, and they're doing the advocacy even before they do the science. And as a result, science becomes tainted, and it becomes something that's more focused on rationalizing what they're already doing, which to me isn't science at all. And a lot of it is misinformation and unproven stuff that they're making claims about and scaring people and scaring mothers about the risks, rather than focusing on real risks and things that are really, truly important. Like, these are important issues. Leukemia, you know, premature births. These are things we should be looking for answers and cures and whatnot. That's where research should be going. But instead, they're doing a lot of advocacy on things like anti-pesticides, you know, focusing on encouraging people to only eat organic food, even though there's no evidence that organic food is safer.
One of the first points you make in the article is that the way that they conduct the research, it lends itself to manipulation. Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I talk a little bit about what's called data mining. And unfortunately, this has become a real problem, not only in environmental science fields, but in science fields across the board, where people churn the data that define statistical associations between one thing and another. So they might want to say that endocrine disrupting chemicals in, you know, from plastics are causing cancer. So they'll pull a bunch of data together, people exposed to plastics, and they'll churn that. They'll connect that to cancers, the people who have cancer illnesses. And if you run your data enough times in enough different ways, 1 in 20 chance you're going to get a positive association. So because they have a 95%, you know, confidence interval. So that would mean 1 in 20 might be a false positive. So a lot of these researchers, they'll just keep working the data. And if you have a small sample, your data is even less reliable. And a lot of times they have these small samples, and they'll just keep working the data until they can find a positive association. You'll see a lot of studies out there that will say, it's suggestive that this chemical causes this health effect, but not definitive, right? There's a lot of factors that go into play, but they take a lot of these small, weak studies to justify what they're doing. And I've looked at a lot of these websites where these groups are doing this research, and they don't say, you know, we're trying to, you know, prove or even disprove a hypothesis. Usually they try to prove the null hypothesis. They're saying we're going to characterize this risk by running, you know, studies and conducting these sort of association-based studies. They've already had their conclusion, and now they're sort of doing the research to meet that predetermined conclusion. And it's a real problem because they can, you know, cite all these studies that are not conclusive but suggestive and sound very convincing about what the effects they're finding are, even though when you look at the full body of research, it's not compelling.
One example you discuss in one of the posts is this health center at Emory University in Georgia, and they put out a video promoting organic food consumption and trying to teach people how to farm organically. And it was a strange video to watch because the instructor in the video says we can't wait for corporations and government to, you know, to provide nutritious food for our communities. And I thought that was just a weird, like, it seemed out of place for a health research institute to be behind something like that. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is a video, a stakeholders video, where they talk about their outreach program. So these centers are asked to create not just the research, but they're creating these outreach programs. And they meet with people in the community, and they try to educate them about what they're going to find in their study, in this case, or they hope to find. And one of the things to talk about is, oh, well, we need food sovereignty. We need to know what we're eating, and we need to know that it's safe and it doesn't have chemicals on it. And they go into a discussion, and this is for pregnant women, mind you, that are concerned that they don't have local grocery stores to get fresh produce all the time. It's not convenient. They talk about farming. I mean, I find it really peculiar that they're teaching pregnant women to farm. I mean, is that really a solution when really maybe the solution is teaching them how to eat healthy, where to how to buy products that have longer shelf life, like canned goods and vegetables in the freezer section? They come up with this really crazy concept of urban farming. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Certainly, no one person is going to be able to grow everything they need anyway. And it's a lot of work. Farming is hard. When in fact, at the same time, again, conventional produce, which is more affordable than the organically farmed stuff, is a perfectly healthy option. And, you know, if you have to make less trips to the supermarket, you know, frozen produce is fine too. So people need more information about how to eat, not how to produce food. I just thought it was really an unusual suggestion.
One interesting point you make is that when you look at the weight of the evidence, organic food versus conventional food is really no different when it comes to nutrition. And then, of course, taste is highly subjective. So there's really no way to rate that. So how do they deal with that? Do they deal with that evidence at all? Do they just ignore it entirely?
Well, you know, I think they kind of ignore it because their real research area is supposed to be on how microorganisms in the human body, what they call the microbiome, affects premature pregnancy. And there is some evidence that genetic differences between African-American women and other women mean that the African-American women lack certain bacteria and in their bodies that other women have. And that absence may actually be a causal factor. So it's an area that actually is really worth researching. It has nothing to do with eating organic food or, you know, conventional food, which is why this video is so peculiar, and all their advice really seems unrelated to their area of research. So it appears to me that they use that area of research as a context to do something completely unrelated. And I think that's very sad because it's an important question. And, you know, it is an important area of research and it should be taken seriously, not relegated in a sense to their agenda, which is completely different.
Sure. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the ramifications that might come as a result of focusing on issues like this. But before we get there, I believe it's the center at Emory actually links to and promotes the research of the Environmental Working Group, which, for those who are unaware, is a very partisan environmental activist group. And they put out the Dirty Dozen list of vegetables every year. And they do a lot to promote misinformation about pesticide exposure. And yet their work is being used to promote this. And just as a counterfactual, if say Bayer was funding a group and then some university promoted that group's work, we would never hear the end of the conflict of interest that represents. But on this, you know, the media doesn't say anything. These groups are obviously okay with it. So talk about that. Why Why the double standard, do you think?
Well, it's very interesting because it's not just this group. So this one group, they actually link to the educational material resources on the Environmental Working Group's website. But a lot of these groups link to the Natural Resources Defense Council. They're all part of the same network. So really, this is a web of activist groups. They're lobbying for this funding, and these groups are producing the research that these activists can use to lobby for more funding and for more regulations. And I don't see it as just a coincidence. For instance, there's a group at Columbia University, and if you look on their website, there's a lot of activist groups that are linked to it, and they're involved in a lot of environmental activism. And they were behind their research, which EPA Science Advisory Panel found uncompelling, was still trying, they were still trying to use that research to ban the pesticide chlorpyrifos, which is really important for orange growers and lots of fruits and vegetable producers to fight very serious diseases and challenges that they have to produce healthy food and an ample food supply. They almost succeeded. The Trump administration pushed back away from the Obama's proposed ban. You'll hear a lot of people saying they overturned the ban. No, they just didn't proceed with the ban because their science advisory panel said that study was basically unusable. The data wasn't very good. And again, they were churning the data, in my opinion, to create results that served a political agenda. So this is all part of a network. It's not a coincidence that these groups are so tightly close, connected with these other research entities.
Now, was that the Obama administration's EPA? Was it their advisory panel that said this study is no good, or was that later on after Trump was elected?
It was during the Obama administration. In fact, for most of the time, EPA was already in the process of, you know, they do these reevaluations of the chemicals every so many years. When they finish one, they take so long, it's time for the next one, you know, every 10 years or whatever. So they were already working on that. Environmental group petitioned, Pesticide Action Network petitioned EPA to go ahead and ban it anyway, right away. Just don't finish the research, don't do anything. EPA was moving in the direction of not doing that. At the end of the Obama administration, all of a sudden they switched gears and said, hey, let's ban it. You know, let's use this Columbia University study. But they did that despite the fact that 6 or 8 months earlier, the science advisory panel said this study the data is not very good. It's not reliable. It's not a good measurement for exposure. So what EPA did is they said, okay, well, the data isn't very good, so we'll make up new data and we'll apply it to the study. That's exactly what they did. They guesstimated what women's exposures or families' exposures and children's exposures were to this chemical, and they made the data fit their desired conclusion. Then they proposed the ban. Trump administration comes in. There's a deadline for them to either finalize it or not proceed, and they decide not to proceed, and they've been sued at least once, a couple times they've been in court, and then they just came out with the determination that they're not going to proceed with that, but they are continuing the research to reevaluate the science, what they're required to do every 10 years. So they haven't stopped looking into it, but they're not just going to ban it before they have finished that process.
So my next question, which you kind of set up, so the EPA is now battling this controversial research that a lot of experts have said is really not reliable data. But I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the EPA is one of the two federal agencies that's funding this research in the first place. Is that correct?
Yeah, EPA is funding 50% of these in Children's Environmental Health Center. So again, you can see, like, it's all worked out. They EPA, during the Obama years, the Clinton years, actually, they set up these centers to fund research that the activists could use to go back to EPA and push EPA to do certain things. It's taxpayer funded. EPA funds half of it, and the other half is funded by the National Institutes for Environmental Health Sciences, which is at NIH, the National Institutes for Health. EPA has decided that they want to cut their half of the funding. There's certainly better things we can do with the money. NIH is continuing to fund, although they say some of these centers may be threatened, you know, because they won't have money. I say if they're really doing legitimate helpful research, they can attract private dollars. I don't think taxpayers should pay for it, but certainly taxpayers shouldn't pay for the activist side. So that's where we are in the debate now. Today, yes.
Environmental Working Group and some of these other organizations, they'll say that that big ag like Monsanto has bought off the EPA. The agency's in their pocket, but your work seems to totally reverse that. It seems that these groups actually have more influence than they're letting on. So talk about that if you would.
Absolutely. So big business is, sure, big business has an impact on regulation because they are being affected and they need to lobby to promote their products and protect them. And they're often beat up because of that. The assumption is that anything that industry says must be tainted because they make profits and that, you know, they're bad people. And the assumption that the environmentalists are all good. My argument would be, you know, there are interest groups that are influencing policy all the time. We want to make sure that we look at the science and not at necessarily the special interest. I do think that these activist groups are not purely interested in, unfortunately, children's environmental health. They really are interested in power. They're interested in working the system. They seem to like regulations no matter what. So, you know, they're very influential in a lot of ways. I did my PhD dissertation on this. They're more influential than business because they sound like they're so altruistic. You know, a business, it's assumed that it's a negative, but the business is trying to produce products that enable farmers to make food. I generally think that's a good thing. They try to make pharmaceuticals or whatever it is, and they're just being beat up all the time. I think that it should be fair that the full science should be looked at, whether it's business or private or whatnot. And it should be rigorous. And this stuff is not rigorous. It's totally political, at least the advocacy side, which seems to be, you know, playing a bigger role in a lot of these centers than actual research.
Going back to the point you made earlier about this research diverting funds away from really important questions we should be examining, how severe of a problem is that? I mean, it's not just a matter, it's not an academic matter, in other words, that, you know, we're just funding bad science. This has real implications.
I mean, I don't know. I can't tell you what the slice of the pie is exactly. I mean, I'm sure a lot of research is going for good things and other programs and whatnot, but I don't know what slice of the pie this activist research is going. But I don't know that it's a dollar and cents thing as much as it is the danger they create by creating misinterpretations of reality, misinterpretations of risk. They confuse mothers. They confuse, you know, individuals. They create fear where it doesn't need to exist. And then they also undermine the products that are necessary for us all to have affordable food and to disinfect our homes and to produce medical devices and things of that nature that we need in hospitals. They could create greater risks by doing that, you know, then these, I would say a lot of them phantom risks or risks that are so tiny that they can't even be measured. Meanwhile, you know, for instance, blood bags, there's a group that's called Healthcare for No Harm, and they wanted to ban the plasticizers that make blood bags soft, but there's no alternative that keeps the blood supply lasts as long. So now you're creating a situation, you know, where we have blood shortages where we could have spoilage. Their idea that, you know, glass is a substitute for these plastics is ridiculous. I mean, glass breaks and you could have waste. There's a whole host of medical devices from vinyl tubing, you know, that's put at risk. You know, they get mercury, you know, removed from medical equipment and it's harder to read people's blood pressure, you know, and not to know whether they're going to have a stroke. So as they start picking these products out, there are real costs to society and to public health.
Well, final note, and then we'll let you go. But has anyone else covered this? Because I haven't seen any media coverage of it. I haven't even seen most of the, you know, the more science-based organizations looking at this question. Were you the first person to examine this?
I may not be the first person. I might be the first person to sort of start systematically looking at it. I think people, I started looking at it when the chlorpyrifos decision was coming down because I was like, what is this Columbia Center, you know? And I looked at it and, you know, I originally assumed that this must be a scientific center, but why do they have this crazy research? And I started looking at it and I see, you know, they're working with the NRDC and all these other crazy groups that are lobbying for regulations. And I started looking at their other activities and I realized that there's something else going on. And then just recently, when the Trump administration announced they wanted to cut the funding, I said, just started to look at what they were cutting, and I found a lot of crazy stuff. And I really just started to survey it. It wasn't hard to find this stuff. You know, it is hard to try to say, hey, your scientific research isn't any good. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe some of these centers are doing something in behind the scenes, but what my concern is what they're doing up front and in the communities is not science-based. They call it, and this is the new thing you're going to start hearing about, is between translation of science or translational science. It's an area where you're supposed to take what you've learned in the laboratory and help people in society improve public health and translate that information. But they haven't done the science, so they have nothing to translate. And that's really, they're not finished with the science, at least. So that's really problematic.
Yeah, and how convenient that, you know, what it translates to is we need to eat organic food and avoid synthetic pesticides. Wouldn't you know it?
They're starting with that, and they're trying to translate that into science. And you can't do science in reverse. You have to come, you know, translational science is a legitimate field. It's in the biomedical field. And but they take these very legitimate scientific areas or scientific studies, and they try to wrap themselves within there to do something completely different. And it's very hard to argue with it when they do that. So you've got to be very careful to make sure that, you know, you're looking at the right part of it. And so my concern isn't that people are interested in scientific discovery. I just wish they would have discoveries before they start translating their agenda.
All right. Well, I think that's a good point to leave our discussion. Thank you so much for joining me. If people want to read these articles and find out more about your work, where should they go?
They can go to cei.org and go to our blog page and look under my name.
All right. Well, Angela, thank you so much, and we'll have to have you back sometime.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. I want to remind you before we go to check out geneticliteracyproject.org. If you sign up for our newsletter, we will send you new articles and news updates, as well as these podcasts, right to your inbox. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.